Welcome to the Science Line. I'm Scott.
And I'm Lisa. We're here to learn about the science that's happening here in our Idaho community, but we're also challenging scientists who dare to come on our show to think about how they communicate their research to people who know nothing about it, but whose tax dollars are funding it, like us.
But we're not going to take it easy on our guests. They will have to pay for their communication faux pas, like using ridiculous and unrelatable science terms and jargon, and they better not bore us. Based on how well they do, we'll assign them written homework in the form of lines. Hopefully, this will remind them of their blunders and what not to do next time.
Geez, take it easy, Scott. No one's going to want to come on our show if you keep carrying on like that.
So, Risa, we're on to episode 4 of The Science Line.
I know, it's really exciting, and I can't help but keep thinking about our conversation last week with Dr. Mark Macbeth and his advice on using storytelling or narratives in science communication.
Yeah, and this week, I really want to touch on a related subject, and that is the use of language when we're trying to communicate science.
Right? Language and tone can make a big difference. Like, what if I said, Scott, you're so stupid for not believing that, right? Versus, oh, Scott, well, tell me about what you think. Let's talk about it.
Yeah, it's all about credibility and trustworthiness. If in debates, we get really heated and we start using aggressive language, that can actually seem to work to reduce our credibility.
Yeah, I agree. It can definitely push people away. I think it's just like with anything in communication among humans, when we become defensive or aggressive, right? Generally, the other party starts to turn their backs or walk away because unless they're aggressive as well, right? Sometimes you get too aggressive people in a conversation, but again, it generally doesn't end well.
Yeah, and I think at the moment we're seeing a lot of politically charged topics being debated in the news. So
absolutely.
For instance, you know, climate change, COVID-19, mask wearing. We see experts and they're just trying to stay calm because they know if they don't, they're going to really lose some of this credibility.
Yeah, and it's not to say that they aren't credible, but part of being credible is being able to, I think, communicate in a way where the other person feels like they're being heard as well, right? It's very important that we feel heard no matter what side of the issue we're on, right? And it's once we start to have productive conversations where we can both say, okay, like, let's look at it this way. You know, can you see where I'm coming from my perspective? And then say, you know, well, this is what the science is saying. And you have something that's just a nice, calm back and forth. I think that's when people open up and you start to see things from different perspectives. And then once you have all the information, you can make your own decision on where you want to go with that.
Yeah, I mean, it's tough for scientists sometimes when they're just faced with ideas like flat earth. You know, you could see where some people are getting really frustrated. But actually, you know,
It's true. I can see where the frustration comes from. But on the other hand, like, I have personal, you know, experience with this. I grew up in an environment in which I was told that evolution is bad, right? And that I should have nothing to do with evolution or believe in it. And I remember going to college and taking classes. I was a biology major. And I remember my eyes being opened up to this brand new world, right? And it wasn't in an aggressive way. It was just through coursework. And now when I teach students, I feel like my own background has made me much more sympathetic in the way that I approach teaching concepts that aren't controversial in science but tend to be controversial in the general public. I approach that very differently because I feel like I have sympathy and understanding for students when they come in with a background that's different than what the scientific community at large, what we know within science.
Yeah, I think this is especially true when we're faced with different religious backgrounds and different cultural beliefs. So we really have to make sure we're sensitive in the way that we communicate our science. And actually, doing that is not just the right thing to do, but it actually does, as we've mentioned, maintain and lend us that sense of credibility.
I agree. I think maintaining a level of sensitivity is very important. And then also as a scientist, you know, when I teach certain topics, like, we focus on the science.
Absolutely.
Well, somebody who may be able to help us with the debate on language is our guest today, Dr. Roger Schmidt. Roger is a professor of English here at Idaho State University with a specialty in 18th century British literature. Well, Scott, when I heard this, 18th century British literature, I wondered why we even needed Roger, because I thought you were an expert in this.
Yeah, other than being British, I know very little about British culture, although I do enjoy a spot of afternoon tea.
Okay, fair enough. And so, Roger, we have a question for you. This is called a science line. And every show, we assign our guest a line, right? When you were in school, if you got in trouble, you got assigned lines, right? And you had to go write them on the board. And so we're wondering, when you were in school, were you a good student, or were you one of those that had to go to the board fairly often and write your line?
Well, I've never had to write my line on the board, but that doesn't mean I was a good student. Are we talking college or are we talking elementary
anytime.
School?
Oh, anytime. I think it was probably more common in elementary school, high school, where, like, if you're talking in class, the teacher, you know, pegs you and says, you come up to the board and write, I will not talk in class,
or
you know,
25
times.
Or if you like Dr. Macbeth from last week, he told us he was getting paddled if he did.
Well, I got paddled
a few times.
Oh, well, then the science line, that punishment is nothing, right, in the form of writing lines. And so, the idea is that we judge you based on how well you communicate what you do and then assign you a certain number of lines at the end of the show based on that. So no pressure. No pressure at all.
So what is the line that I have to write?
Right. That's the big question. What did we come up with for you?
So your line is, thou shalt justify the use of the word thou.
Thou shalt justify the use of the word thou.
Yeah.
Oh, that's a good one. I write that down.
Yeah.
The only thing we knew about the 18th century was maybe that people used the word thou. So we figured that was an appropriate statement.
Did people even use the word thou in the 18th century?
Oh, certainly, but not necessarily in everyday language.
Okay. Well, that's a relief for us, Risa, because otherwise we would have looked really silly.
I know.
Yeah, but there's a very interesting book, I and Thou, by the theologian Martin Buber. And I think as biologists, you would be interested in it. And that if we treat nature not as an it, but as a thou, we have a much more healing, much more engaged relationship to nature, thou rather than an it.
Very good. Well,
so I like the sentence. I'll be happy. I hope you assign me a lot of lines.
I kind of feel like you have just justified the use of the word thou, like, very quickly into the episode. Yeah. Like, that kind of hit the mark for me. I was like, oh, maybe it is justifiable to use the word thou.
So maybe this is a good chance to jump straight into your two-minute why should we care segment. What we are looking for is, why should our listeners really care about what you do at the university? So how does your work help society, and how might other people find it just interesting?
Well, I like the last part, just interesting. I think so many things are just intrinsically interesting, inherently interesting in and of themselves, and worthy of study. One thing I do, and I brought you some quills here, is that I have taught students how to write with a quill. Specifically, I've taught them how to forge Jane Austen's handwriting. I thought this would be an interesting way to teach Austen, and this was about 10 years ago when I started doing this. And it was, and not just teaching them her handwriting, which is an 18th century round hand, but in learning that how to write in that particular script, they would learn how she constructs a sentence, they would learn her such precise vocabulary, the way she phrases things. It's absolutely, I mean, she's one of the great prose stylists of all time, no question about that. And so you learn how to forge her handwriting, but at the same time you pick up some of her stylistic features that make her such a great writer. And you also learn a lot about manuscripts. You study her manuscripts. You learn about the history of the printed word, the history, the way handwriting has evolved. And so you learn about history, you learn about the technology of handwriting, how the very letters we use every day, we do not think about where they came from, but they have such a rich history.
I'm Scott Greaves, here with my co-host, Dr. Risa Ledbetter. Our guest today is Professor Roger Schmidt. After this short break, we'll continue our conversation. Stay with us for questions and trivia on the Science Line. Thanks for tuning in to The Science Line on KISU. I'm Scott Greaves, here with my co-host, Dr. Risa Ledbetter. Now, we're going to jump back into our conversation with Professor Roger Smith.
What you talked about with having students forge these famous people's handwriting is really amazing. And we understand that you studied at the Rare Book School in Chawton, England, where you actually learned to do this, and then you've taken what you learned and applied it in your classes.
Yes, a slight conflation there. I've studied at Rare Book School at the University of Virginia at Chawton House in England, which is where Jane Austen lived.
Oh, okay.
Or she lived in a cottage adjacent to Chawton House. And I was staying in the stables there. And I taught myself how to forge Austen's handwriting while living there on the estate.
When you say forge, how do you learn to write like someone else did? Is it like you put a piece of paper over their writing and then write? Like, what is the process of forging and learning how to do that?
Well, that's a good question. It sounds easy enough, but it's actually fairly difficult. And I've gone through various ways of doing it. Now I provide students with instruction in 18th century roundhand, which is an idealized script. Austen wrote in a roundhand, but with her own idiosyncrasies, as every writer does.
Right.
But you teach them the letter strokes first of English roundhand. And it's mixed in with a little bit of English copperplate in Austen's cases, some letters. It's not a pure idealized script that she wrote in. But you teach them basic calligraphy skills, how to make these letters, how to write in cursive. And then you have them study the manuscripts. There are a lot of digitized versions, so you can really zoom in on a letter, you know, and really see the strokes at close detail, and you just imitate it. You keep writing, and that's how you learn. I mean, you learn by imitation. That's how writers learn how to write, and this is a sort of learning by imitation, but you're learning not just handwriting, you're learning how they composed a sentence.
Right. So, they get a grade?
Oh, of course, they get a grade.
But, I think I'd like that. That actually sounds really fun. You have to be really meticulous, and that sounds fun to me.
So far on the show, we've had a biologist, a geologist, and a political scientist. And I think it's fair to say that research done by faculty in those departments follow a similar path to conduct their research. But Risa and I are really interested in how is research conducted within the English department, particularly into literature? So if you're going to actually put something forward for publication, what's the process that you go through?
Well, research begins in graduate school, as you know, and the PhD thesis is or dissertation is where you learn the fundamental aspects of doing research. In my case, I did it on a fairly obscure 18th century historian, Roger North, and I just wrote about him in a political context. And for the first few years of my career at ISU, I built on that research until I got sick of it. Other things I've done, I got very interested in the history of sleep. Samuel Johnson was a noted insomniac, and the more I read about it, I thought, oh, this is just fascinating. Why didn't he sleep more? So I thought about the effect of caffeine on people's sleep, the effect of the novel, which was just coming into prominence as a genre. So people would drink coffee, stay up all night reading novels, and time. That's when we moved to artificial time. I mean, the first pendulum clock is 1658.
So you would look to put, or you would look to take a new perspective from a historical piece of work and understand why they wrote in the way that they did and why they were interested in the items that they were interested in?
Yeah, I think that's a good way of putting it.
Okay.
That's the way I do research, you know, looking at it in a new perspective. But putting it in a new context, I mean, my latest research is on the painter William Hogarth, and there's a particular painting that I've studied now for about 5 years. Nobody has really understood it. You look at it in the context of medicine, particularly corpse medicine, and suddenly this painting makes all the sense in the world.
Oh, wow.
But people have said, well, it's a very obscure painting, the most difficult to interpret of all his works, until suddenly you shift the context and you say, oh, that's what this is all about. Eating skull, powdered skull, for example, was at the heart of that one. So the new context, same things that people have looked at, but a new context.
I think think that that's really neat. I have to tell you, this might make you sad. When I was a child, my grandmother took me to the movie theater, and you probably remember the movie Emma, right? Which was based on Jane Austen's book.
Is this the one with Gwyneth Paltrow?
It's that one.
Yeah, the 1996.
And I just kept falling asleep over and over, and I remember realizing, oh, you know, is history like maybe not my thing? And so I want to know, what sparks your passion for history, and should I take your class to light mine?
Well, okay, you said a lot there. I think the first thing, though, is that people love Jane Austen's movies, and I like the quote. I put it on my syllabus. I love Jane Austen. I've seen all of her movies. They get the book, and they say, whoa, this is quite different. Mm-hmm. And the difference is amazing between reading her prose, the depths of psychology and human behavior that she explores in the most graceful way imaginative, and very ironic. That's a different experience. Mm-hmm. So I hope you read those books.
So you think, yeah. So I was going to say, you think I should read the books?
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
Everybody should. Mm-hmm. I mean, here I came across it. I thought, oh, I'll say this today. Yesterday I was reading some Dostoevsky, and the introduction said, Einstein, you know, who was perhaps the most imaginative person of the last century, said, Dostoevsky gives me more than any scientist can. And so for sure, you should be taking a class on Jane Austen or 19th century Russian literature.
To be inspired.
To be inspired, yes. To be imaginative, to think about things in a different way.
And right. Well, and I feel like the way that you've talked about it today has me intrigued, actually, because not just with the, you know, quills and ink pens, but also thinking about how you take something that's happened in history and you read these books or you look at these paintings and then you provide new perspective on them. That's also neat to me, thinking about it from that perspective.
Mm. I want to tell you about how we studied history in primary school. So when I was about 10 years old in England. So they would make us dress up and go to Victorian workhouses, real Victorian workhouses. Yeah. Obviously, now have been turned into not museums, but experiences. Mm. So you can go and you engage in what would have been a traditional Victorian student's day and a day in their life. And so we would go and we would sit down with a really scary teacher who would slap the ruler and throw the and we would also have to go into the factories and see the horrible conditions that children would have to experience in the Victorian era. And actually, it was really scary. But I wonder, why do you think it's important for children and even adults to understand the context of history?
Why is it important to look back? I think it's just so fascinating to see where we are now. Mm. You can go back to the Victorian era, and it's not that far back in time, really. But to see how did we end up where we are. I mean, people call me sometimes. Well, they hear about your writing with a quill. You must be a Luddite, and I think you go back to that point in history, and you think this is a fascinating period when they were destroying cottage industries. I mean, families had their own mode of making. Textiles, people would come around, they're very well made, and suddenly you get the knitting frames, you know, the automated knitting frames in the factories. Kids are going to one factory, parents are going to another factory. You've destroyed the home and you're producing cheap goods and you're creating these dark satanic mills, as Blake says. That seems like a definitive point in history that still resonates today. People mm-hmm. complained about it. There were riots, you know, the Luddite riots, but and people say, well, they're just against technological progress. They were against this destroying the family structure, and their families were destroyed, and kids went off and worked, as you say, in the Victorian workhouses for 14, 15 hours a day, 6.5 days a week, no safety precautions.
Yeah, and that's if you escaped being a chimney sweep or something.
Oh, like yeah, that. Blake's poem about the chimney sweep, you know, where they put young boys down in chimneys, sometimes with the fire still going, and You're familiar with those poems.
We did actually have to study this a fair bit in school, yeah. Yeah. So you're feeling out of the loop here.
Yeah, totally. I did not have those experiences growing up.
So, that was fascinating, but I'm aware of the time, so we probably should move on to trivia, which, as we all know, is the true test of how much you know.
Yeah.
All prior conversations mean nothing. It's all about trivia.
Okay.
Okay. So.
All right. We've tried to take, we read your bio and we pulled some questions that we were like, he should definitely know these, right, Scott?
Yeah, exactly.
They're not the obscure questions.
No.
No, we'd never choose those.
Oh, of course not. So my first question is, what part of Shakespeare's skeleton is thought to be missing from his tomb?
I didn't know there was a tomb for Shakespeare.
Well, I think by tomb it is just a... Okay, I'll give you a clue. He's buried in one of the many Trinity churches. Probably doesn't help.
No, that doesn't
help. I don't think that helps at all.
So what bone is missing from his skeleton?
Yep. What part of his skeleton
is missing? This actually is a clue. What part of Shakespeare would he have perceived to be the most valuable?
His fingers.
That's like a really good answer.
But no, it was his skull.
Oh, his skull is missing.
Okay. Yeah, but fingers is a good one.
I honestly think he probably could have functioned without his fingers, but without his skull, yeah. Probably not. Yeah. So I stand by my statement.
Okay. So I have to write one line for that one?
Yeah, of course.
More lines. Okay. Yep, exactly.
Yeah, so a team actually used ground-penetrating radar to actually look into his burial site, and they found that... his skull was missing. And there was actually a news report in the late 1800s that suggested some grave robbers had been in and stolen his skull. And it was just pushed aside as fake news, to put it in modern terms.
Yeah.
But it turns out there was some truth in it. No, it looks skull. Like his skull is missing.
Ah. Mm-hmm.
So I got to learn a little bit more about Jane Austen because of having you on the show. And we know that you learned to forge her handwriting, but did you also learn to edit your writing like she did? What kind of editing strategy did Jane Austen use for at least one of her manuscripts?
What do you mean by editing?
Like in terms of if she needed to insert text somewhere.
Oh, yeah, she would take pieces of paper and pin them into her manuscript.
Oh, man, yeah. You're so good. I knew that you were like the Jane Austen expert
but
here.
The question of editing is really a much fascinating one. We don't know. Some people posit that she had a very good editor and all of those commas and dashes and semicolons were put in there by an editor.
Not actually her.
Yeah, and we don't have her manuscripts to look at. I mean, they were destroyed after the novels were printed.
Wow.
So, wow.
There's scholarly debate about how much of the punctuation that you read in Austen was actually Austen's own punctuation.
Oh, that's really interesting.
So my final question is, what was the life expectancy in 18th century England? And for a bonus point, how much longer would the royalty be expected to live than the common folk?
Well, you'll have to explain the life expectancy for whom and whether you want the average life expectancy or the median life expectancy.
So I am after the mean life expectancy for the common folk of England throughout the 18th century.
Okay. I mean, life expectancy gets thrown off because infant mortality was so high.
Oh, yeah.
If you survived infancy, I would guess around 55, 56.
That's a pretty good guess. Have here that it was 49 years old.
Okay.
But for the bonus point, how much longer do you think the royalty would have expected to live?
I don't know. Let me say 12 years.
10.
Wow.
10 years. That's pretty close. They're both pretty good guesses, actually.
No,
that was really good.
Oh, man, you really killed it in trivia today. Nice job.
Well, I've never heard about I should have gotten Shakespeare's skull.
But fingers, I have to give you credit for, like, based on Scott's clue, yeah. good answer. Oh, man. So we get to the last part of the show. We're done with trivia. Great job. It's now time to assign you your lines for how well you did
So what was the
in
line
communicating
Lisa?
Your work.
thou shalt justify the use of the word thou. That's your line, right? And we're going to give you, this is what we decided, 1,700 lines. And you wanted a lot of lines. Hey, you got your wish because you love the 18th century so much. We thought 1,700 was very appropriate.
Oh, yeah. Very good. Well, how about 1745?
Oh, was that your favorite year?
One of them.
Oh, okay, good. Perfect.
1795.
God, you keep asking for more.
You keep asking for more. This is the first time. Wow. Yeah. Wow. Yeah. Yeah. You really love what you do.
Yes.
Oh, that's great. Well, we really appreciate you being here, Roger. It's really been a pleasure. And if you are a scientist or graduate student and are interested in being on our show, please send your contact information to the science line at isu.edu.
And I think I'll finish by saying these are probably going to be the most beautifully produced lines.
Oh, ever. We're definitely expecting you to use a quill.
Yeah.
100%.
Okay. Right. Thank you so much. That was great.
Oh, thank you.